Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me for today's show. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Coming up, we'll talk about kids and some concerning coronavirus complications. We'll hear from a local pediatrician about that. We'll also talk about increased stroke risk in COVID-19 patients, and we'll find out when and how elective surgeries will return. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Buchholz, at week's end, St. Louis County Executive Dr. Sam Page outlined some of the guidelines for a partial reopening of businesses in the St. Louis area starting on May 18th. Here's some of what he said.
For some of our businesses to reopen, we'll first review those that we consider to still be high risk for transmission of COVID-19 infections, and those will remain closed. Those will be entertainment, conference and sporting venues, sports courts and playgrounds, public indoor and outdoor pools, gyms and fitness centers, banquet rooms, and sporting events. This will not include professional sports teams who are practicing without spectators. Bars and businesses that who serve alcohol and do not serve meals will be limited and will continue to be limited to carry out and curbside services. For businesses to open or to remain open, they must adopt these public safety standards. Frequent disinfection of all high-touch areas. Provide reasonable breaks for employees to wash their hands. To train employees on social distancing guidelines. To provide them with masks or materials to wear masks. To require employees to wear masks in a place of business. And to adopt signage and markings so everyone can understand how social distancing will be followed in each place of business. They will need to continue daily screenings of employees for a risk of a COVID-19 infection and encourage and allow anyone who tests positive for COVID-19 to go into an isolation process until they recover, and anyone who is in close contact and needs to be quarantined while they are waiting to see if they develop COVID-19, they must make arrangements for that as well, in cooperation, of course, with our public health department. Businesses that have direct interaction with the public will be limited to 25% occupancy of their rooms, their buildings, based on building code and fire code. They will install physical barriers any place where social distancing of 6 feet is not easily accomplished. And they will prohibit customers from bringing in outside containers into the place of business. We would also expect to see arrangements for, whenever possible, for touchless payment, for touchless delivery or pickup, and continue those activities as we've seen in our essential businesses. Businesses may also deny entry to anyone who is not wearing a mask. We expect those conversations and interactions to continue to be diplomatic, and we recognize the challenges that we have in our community. But wearing a mask in public whenever social distancing is not possible is strongly, strongly encouraged and will be a big part of our recovery. We will also limit intentional gatherings to 10 people or more moving forward, which would be an exception to the occupancy permits that we previously discussed in these businesses.
That's Dr. Sam Page, St. Louis County Executive. What's your initial reaction to what you heard there, Dr. Buchholz?
Well, I think as we talk about the kind of the phase reopening, I think it's a reasonable set of steps. I guess my first take on hearing that is just enforcement isn't the word I want to use, but it's not wrong either. Of just, you know, how do we ensure that this is done? We've talked about this before, and you start to hear more and more details coming out, particularly like food processing plants, where, you know, a person or two seems sick and they're put in kind of an impossible situation, the worker that is, because, you know, if they don't show up to work, they don't get paid. There's an impetus or, you know, a need to keep things going because, you know, people's livelihood and income are dependent on this. But then it just, you know, we've seen this already. It blows up in just this massive proportion. And, you know, the consequence of this is our entire food supply is at risk. And so, you know, what I worry about with this is, you know, somebody needs the income. They show up to work and they demonstrate symptoms. But you know, depending on the situation, you know, instead of the cautious approach of sending them home, making sure they're taken care of, is they may continue to work because they're worried about losing their job, which is completely understandable. But there just has to be something in place to ensure that the right thing is done here. And that's to me the biggest concern I have with all this. And again, not saying we have to be on lockdown indefinitely, but I think that's a big part of this where I think you're going to have variation in how this is applied. And I don't know if there's any way to control for that, to be fair. But I wish people would understand, if they don't already, is how quickly this gets out of hand. I mean, it gets out of hand before you even recognize what's going on. And I think that's the part that we've got to make sure we recognize. And you have to be very, very aggressive very early in order to get any sense of a handle on this when somebody does have symptoms or you're worried about something coming out. So that to me is the biggest thing. But I think, you know, if they're going to do this, this is the reasonable thing. And I think on the back end, we have to ensure that testing is available. And that to me is the other part that I remain nervous about. But I think that the measures they took seem reasonable. If I was to do it, and thank goodness I'm not, I don't have that capability or capacity, but it seems like a reasonable set of steps.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, what's the latest on elective surgeries returning to the St. Louis area?
Yeah, I think that's coming. And again, in kind of the same way of what Dr. Page kind of outlined, I think it's going to be coming in phases. Groups have kind of made kind of a tiered system of urgency in terms of surgeries, and we're starting to kind of go to the more less urgent tiers, important but not urgent. And I think that's definitely in the works. I think hospitals and medical groups are very interested in kind of getting back to normal, whatever that is, post-COVID. But you know, working on that balance and making sure that all patients are safe. And I think it's going to look like, you know, instead of the routine doctor's visits, you're going to be screened at the door. You know, you're not going to be able to bring many family members, if any, with you. You know, it's going to be a very different approach. But at the same token, I think starting to get back to doing the things we need to do for our patients is being worked on. And I think very much hoping to get things back to whatever the normal looks like. And again, as I said many, many times, I think the new normal is going to be radically different than what things were. I think there's a desire to get things back to where they are. I'm curious to see what that's going to look like, frankly. And I certainly don't know, but I think it'll be radically different.
Dr. Buchholz, I'm hearing about something called a silent hypoxia. What is that? And we're seeing more of it in COVID victims.
Yeah, you know, and that's been an interesting kind of hypothesis about how COVID affects things. And you know, most prominently, one of the ER docs in New York has been a proponent or advocate of this hypothesis or thought. Wrote an op-ed piece in New York Times about 2 weeks ago. But it's this idea that you know, COVID affects the lungs, and the lungs are where we inhale, for lack of a better word, air, which has oxygen in it. That goes to our bloodstream, and at the same time, we exchange carbon dioxide, which is a waste product of metabolism, and that's what we breathe out. And typically, when there's an impairment of that exchange, whatever word, it's manifested, you know, mostly in the sense of breathlessness. You feel short of breath if you're not getting enough oxygen. But then, you know, we can detect that by various things as well. But most commonly, people present short of breath. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Here we're seeing, at least there's been a thought that a lot of patients are not getting good gas exchange and not getting enough oxygen into their lungs, are exchanging that through their lungs to their bloodstream, but feel fine. You know, they'll sit there and tell you, I don't feel short of breath, I feel fine. But then you check their oxygen levels, and they're significantly low. And the idea is that's kind of, you know, with COVID, what we're finding or what we pretty sure about now is, you know, the complications, the bad things that happen with COVID really happen about 7 to 12 days after kind of the onset of the disease, which is unusual for viral infections. Usually that occurs much, much earlier. And that, I think, to a lot of us is kind of an unusual, it's just kind of an unusual pattern of events. And the thought is, as an explanation of this is, you know, the patients that have had this and are being significantly affected or had that low oxygen level for a while, and then, you know, they're able to compensate for a little bit, and then it just kind of bottoms out. And that's, you know, even though they're recovering from the virus per se, the reaction to all these other insults kind of leads to this kind of severe disease.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it. Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk some more about elective surgeries and when and how they might resume in the St. Louis area. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Let's talk a little bit more about elective surgeries and their imminent return. What will they look like once they're back in full service here? Dr. Bruce Hall is Vice President and Chief Quality Officer at BJC Healthcare. He's also a professor of surgery at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Hall, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Hall, where do things stand now across the BJC healthcare system regarding elective surgeries?
Right now, we are not performing elective surgeries and other services across the BJC healthcare system. We are performing those procedures and services which we consider emergencies, and also procedures which we consider urgent and increasingly time-sensitive. But we are not performing any procedures or services that we would call truly elective.
So just kind of define between the two. What are the differences?
Sure. So we think of these problems with respect to three tiers of procedural acuity. In other words, how important is it? How urgent is it? The first tier, tier one, are those services or procedures which are really elective or discretionary. And there's really very little, if any, time sensitivity about delaying that procedure, putting it off for weeks. That's tier one elective. Tier two are procedures that have some element of time sensitivity to them, which means that the more time that goes by, maybe the worse the problem that will get, or else the harder it will be to fix the problem for the patient. And so while they're not considered emergencies, there's an important aspect that they shouldn't be delayed forever, and that's tier two, what we call time sensitive. And then tier three are those services and procedures that are really emergency, urgent things. They need to happen. The patient may be acutely ill, and really there's reason to take care of this problem right away. And so that's tier three, emergent or urgent cases.
Why were these elective surgeries stopped in the first place?
Well, when we were heading into this epidemic and not knowing for certain how many cases and how many hospital admissions we would see, we had a really pressing need to conserve our resources, our equipment, our testing capability, which was really low at the beginning, our hospital's space, our OR space, our breathing machines, all of those things that we need to take care of people, we really had to conserve and prepare for the worst. And so we had to shut down anything that we would call elective or discretionary that didn't really need to happen. We shut it down in order to protect our ability to respond on behalf of the community.
So those Tier 3 emergency and urgent surgeries continue to be done, right?
They've been taking place throughout. By definition, you can't put these cases off. And I think every health system in the entire region and country has continued providing emergency services. So those Tier 3 services have continued throughout. You're correct. Interestingly, what we're seeing, though, is that more Tier 2 cases, cases where we initially thought we could delay them for a little while, can no longer be delayed. And so they've either worsened or it's become more sensitive to the patient. And so what we're seeing is increasingly more cases that would have been Tier 2 are really now Tier 3. And so in conjunction, Tier 2 and Tier 3 are really growing. But again, Tier 1 is where the elective services are, and we are not yet performing Tier 1 elective services.
So do you have any timeline on when you'll be back to full elective surgeries?
Well, we have what I would call planning timelines. So in other words, we're making contingencies and we're generating plans to maximize the safety of our patients and our community. So we have planning timelines, and these involve returning to some elective procedures within the next couple weeks. But there've really been at least two important things that we've been waiting to assess and to evaluate in terms of returning to elective procedures. So one is, will we continue to have enough equipment, personal protective equipment, testing capacity, drugs, hospital beds, other supplies? Will we continue to have enough to take on elective surgery safely? And then the other thing is we wanted to stay aligned with other systems in the region and with our political partners in the region, in city and county government, to make sure that we only took steps that would be consistent with the advice and guidelines and whatever phases are advised by our governmental partners.
And when the elective surgeries get going up again, they're going to look a lot different, aren't they?
Absolutely, you're correct. That's a great insight. Things will be different. And we've already generated a series of communications to patients and families into the community to try to cue people in that things will be different. You'll see social distancing principles maintained. You'll see volumes in clinics be brought down consistent with social distancing. You'll see people wearing masks all the time that you didn't see before. It may take a little longer to get procedures scheduled. You may have fewer visitors. And you may be, if you're a patient, you may be asked to undergo testing to make sure that we take care of you safely and that we protect the safety of everyone in the community. So absolutely, things will be different. And some of them, quite frankly, will be inconvenient. But we hope everybody will understand that we're doing those things for everyone's safety.
Dr. Hall, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Bruce Hall is Vice President and Chief Quality Officer at BJC Healthcare and a professor of surgery at Washington University School of Medicine. Now let's talk about a new universal face masking policy that's gone into effect at all BJC healthcare facilities. Here to explain it to us is Dr. Hillary Babcock. Dr. Babcock is Director of Infection Prevention at BJC Healthcare and an infectious diseases specialist at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Babcock, thanks for talking with us.
Sure, happy to be here.
Dr. Babcock, tell us about this new universal masking policy that's just gone into effect.
Sure. Across BJC Healthcare, we have moved to a universal masking strategy. So this means that all of the people working in our facilities will be wearing masks, and we will also be asking all visitors that are allowed into our facilities to also put on a mask when they come into the building if they don't have a mask on already.
And explain to me why this is needed.
Sure. So what we know about the COVID-19 virus is that it can be spread from people before they develop symptoms. So we were following a policy where we would ask if people had symptoms, and if they didn't have symptoms, we didn't require them to be in a mask. But now that we know that there is a risk even before symptoms occur, we are having everyone put on a mask when they come into our facilities to keep our other patients, other visitors, and our employees safe. And our employees are following the same policy for the same reason.
Are masks being supplied to those who come in who don't have them?
Yes. So in general, I think more and more people are wearing masks in the community, and people have cloth masks and homemade masks. And if people, visitors, come in their own mask, then they are welcome to keep wearing that mask, and we encourage them to come wearing a mask that they already have. But if they don't have a mask, then we will supply one for them.
Are visitors now allowed at certain facilities?
So in general, visitation is still very restricted as we're trying to keep everyone safe and minimize the number of people in our facilities. There are some exceptions to that restriction, and so what we're really talking about are the few visitors that are allowed under these exceptions.
Do children that come into the hospital need to wear a mask?
So children under the age of 2 should not be put in a mask, and any child that can't take the mask off themselves or won't have somebody with them to help them take the mask off shouldn't be in a mask either, just for their own safety.
And again, tell us how critical it is to wear a mask.
Sure. We are really trying to interrupt transmission of this virus throughout our community and in our facilities. And the best way to do that is for everyone to be wearing a mask. And that way, anyone who might be carrying this virus will not spread it to anyone else who is near them.
Dr. Hillary Babcock is Director of Infection Prevention at BJC Healthcare and an infectious diseases specialist at Washington University School of Medicine. Coming up, we'll find out about an increased stroke risk for COVID-19 patients. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
We are learning some scary things about the increased risk of stroke for COVID-19 patients. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Jinmu Lee. Dr. Lee is a Washington University neurologist at Barnes Jewish Hospital. He's also director of the Cerebrovascular Disease Section at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So what are you hearing about strokes in COVID patients?
So there have been several publications very recently that have reported an association between COVID-19 infection and strokes. There was a very recent letter in the New England Journal that described 5 very young patients who presented with very severe strokes at Mount Sinai Hospital. And these patients were all under the age of 50 and didn't have your typical stroke risk factors, but all of them had COVID-19 infection. And so there's a number of other reports that suggest that there might be some association between the virus infection and stroke.
How concerning is this to you?
Well, right now the reports are very preliminary. It's hard to know whether there's a true connection, a true causality, or whether it's just an association. And the reason is the risk factors for bad outcome for COVID-19 are the same as the risk factors for just run-of-the-mill strokes. And so whether the virus is causing the strokes or whether they're just risk factors that both diseases have in common is unclear. However, there are other reports that suggest that COVID-19 can lead to increased clotting throughout the body, so leading to clotting in the lungs, in the kidneys, as well as in the brain. And so it would not be surprising if COVID-19 infection did lead to strokes.
I'm also hearing about large vessel stroke. What is a large vessel stroke, and why are we seeing that as well?
Yeah, so large vessel strokes are strokes that happen where a large artery leading to the brain is blocked off. And these are the most severe types of stroke. The letter to the New England Journal of Medicine that described these 5 cases, all 5 of these cases were large vessel occlusions, again, in very young patients under the age of 50. Now, it would be unusual for so many young people to present to a single medical center, let alone within 2 weeks, which is what they described. And again, none of them had the typical risk factors of hypertension or diabetes but they all did have COVID-19 infection. And this really raises the red flag. Is there an association? Is there causality between the infection and strokes?
So what should we be looking out for?
I think that the main thing is that if you think you're having a stroke, or if you think a loved one is having a stroke, they should come to the emergency room immediately. And I want to stress this because there's a concern that patients are staying away from the hospital out of concern for getting infected with the virus. And so we're actually seeing a decline in the number of stroke patients who are presenting to our hospital by about 30 to 40%. And so I think the most important message I'd like to convey is that if you think you're having a stroke, come to the emergency room.
We're talking with Dr. Jinmu Lee, a Washington University neurologist at Barnes Jewish Hospital and director of the cerebrovascular disease section. Dr. Lee, tell us, what are the warning signs of stroke?
A good way to remember the warning signs of stroke is the acronym FAST, F-A-S-T. So typical symptoms include facial droop, or arm weakness, or slurred speech. And if you have any of these symptoms, it's time to call 911 and come to the emergency room immediately.
Does it matter which hospital you go to?
I think what you want to do is go to a stroke center. And St. Louis has, I think, about 20 primary stroke centers. In addition, there are comprehensive stroke centers, which are capable of much higher level of stroke care. So I think the most important thing is to go to the closest stroke center.
And tell us, what would happen if you have a loved one who you think has suffered a stroke and you have to get them to the hospital? What precautions are taken to keep them separated from possible COVID-19 patients?
A very important point. So hospitals are doing everything possible to triage patients who they suspect may have COVID in separate regions of the emergency room, as well as in separate wards in the hospital. So the patients who are low suspicion or we know don't have COVID, these patients are separated. And so we are doing everything we can to prevent the spread. The most important thing is that there are other emergencies that have to be taken care of. And so we want to do everything we can to prevent the spread of COVID so we can take care of all patients.
Have you seen any cases of stroke in coronavirus patients at Barnes Jewish?
We have had some cases where patients have had neurological symptoms, including stroke-like symptoms, in the COVID units. And so we have seen some this association as well within our hospital.
How is treatment given? Is it extra complicated because of the COVID?
The COVID infection adds some layers of complication. We try to minimize the exposure. A minimum number of doctors who need to see that patient do. But we are implementing all of the care that we did, all the standard of care that we implemented even before COVID, and we're doing the same level of care.
Dr. Lee, thanks a lot. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think you've covered everything.
Dr. Lee, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Dr. Jinmu Lee is a Washington University neurologist at Barnes Jewish Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk about another scary new development regarding coronavirus and COVID-19, kids suffering Kawasaki syndrome symptoms after getting the disease. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Yet another destructive power of the coronavirus, this one involving children. Here to talk with us about that is SLU Care pediatrician Dr. Ken Haller at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Haller, good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Haller, what can you tell us about kids coming down with Kawasaki syndrome-like symptoms once they've had COVID-19?
Well, there was a report out of New York of about 15 kids who came down with a syndrome that looks like Kawasaki disease. They're experiencing fever and rash, abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea. And these kids, when they came into the hospital with these symptoms, were tested, and it looks like a lot of them had COVID-19. So there is a concern that this might be a late manifestation of the disease or sort of a late effect from it. Now, the thing is, it is a very small number of kids, and in general, kids are not terribly affected by COVID-19 and this novel coronavirus. But it is something that we have to be on the lookout for. And as we learn more about this virus and how it shows up in different populations, it's really important for us to be on the alert for these kind of things. So what I would say to parents is if your child is developing fever, rash, abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, call your doctor to find out what's going on. Even if it isn't coronavirus, it could be something serious.
What is Kawasaki disease?
Well, Kawasaki disease is an illness that is it's really characterized by inflammation of blood vessels throughout the body. It's also called mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome, muco meaning the mucous membranes like in the throat, cutaneous meaning rashes on the skin, and lymph nodes meaning swelling of lymph nodes, you know, in the groin and the armpits and in the neck. It can also cause bloodshot eyes and swelling of the hands and feet and a weird peeling of the skin on the fingers and the toes. Nobody quite knows what causes it. It's probably caused by some sort of virus or bacteria. Sometimes it's only seen as a partial syndrome where you might have fever and a couple of manifestations, but not all of them. So when we have seen this in some of these kids after COVID-19, nobody quite knows where it's coming from, whether it's coming from that virus itself or whether it's coming from, you know, perhaps the immune system has been so busy with that coronavirus that now something else is coming in to cause the problem. But of course, if these sorts of things show up in the child, it's really important to have it checked out. Whether it's Kawasaki or not, these are things that would be very disturbing and frightening for parents and kids. And I think the bottom line is, if your kids are sick now, talk to the doctor about what's going on. Call the office to find out if you need to come in or what sort of arrangements can be made. One of the things that's really scary right now is people think, I don't want to bring my kid to the doctor because I don't want them to catch this thing at the doctor's office. But if your child is sick, unfortunately, all the things that make kids sick, all the other things beyond coronavirus are still out there and can make kids sick and still need attention.
And I think I'm also reading that kids are not getting all the vaccines they need for some of those same fears.
Right. One of the things that's really concerning pediatricians right now is that we are seeing a significant drop in vaccination rates, especially for kids under 2 years of age. And this is very, very worrisome. Unfortunately, the things that we vaccinate for, there are 14 microorganisms that cause really bad diseases that we can vaccinate against. This helps to prevent really bad illness. It can even prevent death. And the thing is, they're still out there. So things like whooping cough, things like measles, things like meningitis, kids need vaccines for these, especially when they're young, because the younger a child is, the more likely it is that if they catch one of these infections, that they're going to get really sick from it and maybe even die from it. And what's going on is that a lot of parents, I think quite reasonably, are scared to go into the doctor's office to get a vaccine for their child because they're thinking, well, hospitals and doctor's offices are where the sick kids are. But what's happening is that a lot of kids are not getting their vaccines now. And unfortunately, if kids get sick with these things that we can prevent, that can be really tragic.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Haller. Dr. Haller is a SLU care pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Haller, have you seen any kids at Cardinal Glennon with COVID-19?
I have not personally seen any kids with COVID-19 that I know of. And luckily, the number of kids who have actually been admitted with COVID-19 has been very, very low. To my understanding, we haven't had a kid who's ended up in the ICU from it. And so, you know, as we're hearing, for the most part, kids, if they get sick with this, are not going to get as sick as adults do, for the most part. That doesn't mean they can't get sick. And there have been, in New York, about 6 or 7 kids who've died of complications from COVID-19. Still, it does seem to be affecting mostly the older population. The thing is, with kids, if they do, you know, if they do get this virus, even if they're not very sick, they can pass it on to adults around them, particularly older adults who are more vulnerable to it. So that's why we have to be really careful in terms of making sure that we keep our standards about physical distancing with kids, you know, making that just as important as we do with everyone else in, you know, out in the world with adults.
Dr. Haller, how do you feel about kids wearing masks? At what age should they start doing it?
Well, I think that they should wear masks as early as they feel comfortable with it, probably around 3 or 4 years of age. There's really not at this point a strict guideline on that. For the most part, we want kids not to be going out to be around people who are outside of their family group. So at this point, and most stores are not allowing people to come into the stores with small children. You need to leave them at home. So there really won't be the kind of need for masks in young children that we would have in older kids and adults who might have more reason for actual interaction with other persons. However, if you do have an occasion to go out with a child, I think at this point it's really important for them to learn that at this point in our lives, it's a good thing to wear a mask. As we know, the masks that are available out in the world are not there so much to protect the person who's wearing it, to protect people that the wearer may come in contact with. What masks can do is if we sneeze or cough behind the mask, it can prevent those droplets from going across, you know, a few feet, you know, that less than 6 feet that we talk about to infect someone else, or it might keep those droplets from getting on a surface that someone else can touch. And since kids tend to cough and sneeze a lot because that's the way their bodies work, teaching them how to wear a mask is something that can be really helpful. And it can also teach them that this is something that we do for other people around us, you know, that it is a good idea for them to wear a mask to make sure that people that they might happen to run into will be safe in case, you know, they have something that they could pass on to someone else. And it's, of course, that also means it's important for parents to wear masks when they're out with their kids, whether it's in the park or walking up and down the street. It's just a good public health measure, a good public safety measure, and a way to teach kids how they can care for others.
Dr. Haller, you talked about being out in the park with your kids. What sort of safety tips do you have for parents when it comes to being around a playground with their children?
Yeah, unfortunately, playgrounds are not something that kids should be spending time at, and that is just really, really tough and really unfortunate. The problem with playgrounds is they have all kinds of equipment that kids touch and climb on and sometimes lick. So these, you know, playground equipment like slides and swings and things like that have all kinds of surfaces that can harbor this virus. And so we really want to keep kids away from playgrounds. What we want to do when we're out with kids is have them get some exercise, have them walk around with their parents, make sure that if you run into another group of people, stay 6 feet away from them, that your family group has that invisible 6 foot barrier with other people. You can still wave and talk and chat and stuff like that, but, you know, make sure that that is respected and that you teach your kids to respect that. Again, this is unfortunate, and it's the kind of thing that kids want to go up and hug each other and play with each other and roll around with each other, but this is just not the time to do that. So doing what you can to get your kids out, to get some exercise, to get some sun, to get some fresh air is really important. But teaching them that right now, when we go to the park, we stay with our group, we wave to our friends, and we walk in such a way that we can keep that distance between them and us.
Dr. Haller, always great to talk to you. Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Ken Haller is a SLU care pediatrician at SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. And that's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks so much for joining us. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of the show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.